You know, Everett, I don't think we've ever had a guest who's been so excited to be on the show. And we just like to do this for fun, but this guy absolutely was just dying to be on the show and wanted to be on and talk about, you know, typewriters. And that's always a wonderful thing because we love talking about typewriters. And that's Mr. Scott Connors, also Scotty Connors. Mm-hmm. And he's got a typewriter shop now?
Yeah, Steventown Typewriter Company in New York.
Yeah.
I've talked to him a few times because I work on the Royal Peas, and he had contacted me about some alignment, and I have one torn down and took some pictures of it and took a Sharpie to a red Sharpie to some of the stuff and sent him a picture of where something should be. And he was like, ah, that's clear as a bell.
Yeah. And you know, even as we're recording this, I can hear Tiger out in the background just barking away at the squirrels.
Oh yeah.
And you know, he's as excited as Scotty was to be on our show. So folks, I can't say anything other than hang on. This is going to be a really fun one. So stay tuned right here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Welcome to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to listen to our little gab fest. We're just a group of folks who enjoy the heck out of typewriters and welcome you to our table. Sit back and enjoy the show, and away we go. Hey, Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast listeners, it is Gimme It here. We are back in the ATX. I'm in the house with Evedito. Today, we're actually not in Garaje Henderson, but Evedito is being joined with me at the office, and we have a wonderful guest. How are you doing today, by the way?
Doing great. The weather is beautiful and then rainy, then beautiful, then rainy. So
yeah, so we've had a lot of rain in Texas, which is really good, but let's jump it over to join our guest, Mr. Scott Connors. Scott, where do you hail from, and how are you today?
I'm doing fine. It's a little chilly up here. I'm in Steventown, New York, which is a little town on the Massachusetts-New York border, about 45 minutes from Albany, New York.
Wow. How far is that from Poughkeepsie?
It's about, I think, 3 to 4 hours.
Okay, so it's some distance. Yeah. One time I was in that area, I went to the FDR Presidential Library, and I went through Poughkeepsie going down to New York, New Jersey area.
That's a
area.
Great trip. I've been to that library, and I love going there.
Great. Well, let's talk about typewriters, because that's why we have you on today. And I'm going to let Evedito kind of jump into it with some of the questions. And, you know, before we go into the major depth of our conversation, though, one thing I do want to bring up is let's talk about your shop. You have a new shop that you literally just got going. Talk about that for just a quick minute.
Well, I've been repairing typewriters, collecting them for several years and selling them online. And decided to sort of take the shop public. I'm sticking with the typewriter piece. I didn't make a website or anything like that. I just said I'm going to now use the shop and call it Steventown Typewriter Company because I live in Steventown, and it's the only Steventown on Earth, by the way. And so I said, well, I get a little sign and hung a sign out and said I'm going to start doing that. Although I've been repairing and selling for years now, I just kind of made it formal.
Well, that's wonderful.
That's awesome. Have you had a lot of people coming to you wanting to get restorations or clean their typewriters yet?
Yeah, I've got quite a bit of business from some people locally and to do with repairs. I've also had a lot of people come up and say, you know, I want a typewriter for whatever, writing, or I want to buy a typewriter. One of the fads I've noticed, I don't know if you two have noticed it or not, is get a lot of requests for wedding typewriters mm-hmm. lately. I've done probably 4 in the last couple of years where people want a specific typewriter so when people come into their wedding, they can type instead of writing something in a book. And, you know, it's been one of those deals where people want a specific, well, I want something black and shiny, or I want something yellow, or I want this color. And so I've done a lot of those, and I have people that want repairs. I've also had some people who have family heirlooms that they want refurbished or getting to, you know, back to work, working order. And I do a lot of that stuff. So I do sell a lot throughout the country, but most of my repair work is local.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I did yesterday. My wife and my kids, we went to a BSA, Boy Scouts of America, Eagle ceremony. One of the kids was becoming an eagle, and so we took a typewriter and put it on a table and put a header on it saying that they could wish the kid that was becoming an eagle,
good wishes.
Yeah, it was really awesome because kids are afraid of it, but then they were all over it by the end. But no, the weddings and ceremonies, that's awesome. That's
in terms of your shop, though. Are you going to be doing this full time, or is this just a part time thing for you?
No, it's a part time thing. I work for I'm an IT professional, and I work for a municipality over in Massachusetts. And I mainly do this, nights and weekends. And I drifted into it from the collector's end. And the story is sort of that I'm a writer also. I've published 2 novels. And I sort of lost the feel of writing on a computer. And so I said I wanted something to write with. And I chose a typewriter. And I said, looked around and decided to grab an old 50s Smith Corona Silent. And I was writing on that and said, maybe I should buy one as a backup in case it breaks, knowing nothing about them at the time. And so I bought one, and about 6 months later, I said, these things are a tank. They don't break down. And so I sold it. I went through and kind of cleaned it up and sold it. And then I bought an old 40s Smith Corona Sterling, the black with the stripes on it. And the guy that I bought it from online said it came with a case and that it worked, and it arrived on my doorstep, and neither was true. And I, sent him an email and said, where's the case? And he said, well, I thought I had it, but I didn't. And I said, and it doesn't work. And he said, well, when you push the key down, the little arm comes up. I said, well, some of them do, but half of them are disconnected, and the carriage doesn't move. So he was like, well, I'm sorry. So I had it sitting on my kitchen table, and I said, this would be a good experiment. And so I ripped the entire thing down and put it back together and learned a lot of lessons along the way, made a lot of notes, learned that you should always separate your screws and take plenty of pictures and plenty of notes, and put it back together, and then started repairing them. And I was bought the 3 or 4 of the typewriter repair Bibles, which are just that. They're great resources. And I was able to make an acquaintance of a gentleman over in Troy, New York. His dad ran Troy Typewriter Service for years and had closed the business. And he was working, doing a little bit of typewriter stuff out of a shed in his backyard. And so I went over one day, and he was very kind, gave me some tools, gave me some instructions and some lessons on stuff. And then over the years, just proceeded to be sort of the person who will say to me, he'll call me up and say, hey, I got some stuff for you, stop over. And he's given me typewriters. And I recently got a big typesetter's cabinet from him with a lot of supplies. So that just, it sort of morphed into a life of its own on my repair business. And I sort of consider myself more of a preservationist rather than a restorationist. I know Everett and I kind of talk back and forth about stuff. I love some of the stuff he does in terms of painting typewriters and doing that. I'm not artistically inclined whatsoever, although I'm a writer and a musician. I sort of say, well, I want to take that typewriter and bring it back to how it was working when it came off the factory floor or how that person had it. So I don't usually go through and put on new decals or paint them or do that type of stuff. More along the lines of I just try to preserve what's there.
Let me talk a little bit about, or not me, let's have you talk a little bit about what preservationist means, because I know that in the typewriter community, we have folks that are purists, people who, like sort of what you said, that they do not want a typewriter. Let's say it's given to you and it's not in working condition, it's got scratches over it and whatnot, but then you take it into your shop, and you said you're going to put it back to the way it came off the factory floor. But a lot of the younger people these days, especially, some older folks too, but mostly younger people, they get a typewriter and they start working on it. I'm very impressed in that capacity. But sometimes people want to repaint it a pink or psychedelic purple, whatever. What is your thoughts in that as a preservationist?
Well, it's to each their own. I'm also a classic car collector, and I have a 1968 Cadillac, and it's all original and unrestored with 30,000 miles on it. I mean, I've replaced, obviously, the oil and the tires and that kind of stuff.
Everett's jaw just hit the table.
And it's one of those things where I was at a car show years ago, and there was all these beautiful classic cars around. And there was this one old Buick from the 30s sitting there. And the guy had a little sign in the window, and he said, it's only original once. And I thought, wow, what a great sentiment. And so I sort of look at typewriters like that and say, you know, if they're functioning, can I bring them back to where they were? And one of the earliest examples I had was I had a gentleman give me his wife's grandfather's Corona 3. And it was, we met in a library parking lot at night. And so I looked at it and said, oh yeah, this shouldn't be too bad. And I didn't really have a chance to look at it until I got it home. And when I got it home, it was in extremely bad shape. It had been either very close to a fire or in a fire. You know, the paint was bubbled and there was a lot of issues with it. And at the time, you know, I was trying to get it back to where it was. And I ordered, you know, new rubber for it. I started to clean it. I started to try to get the paint back to a spot where I said, okay, I'm gonna get it, you know, there. And just in taking care of the paint and trying to preserve it, a lot of the paint did come back. I ordered, you know, new rubber for it. And then I found that it was, they believe that it was an old Army typewriter because he was in the Army. What I found through some research was that it wasn't, it actually had an italic typeface, which back then in 1917, you had to literally go into the store and order as a special order. So that was one of the machines that I just preserved it. And when I got it back to them, his wife literally broke down in tears and was like, I cannot believe, you know, that this came back and looked like this. Now, I literally could have sanded it down or repainted it and put decals on it, and it would have looked new. But my feeling on it was that it was a family heirloom, and she wanted it the way her grandfather had left it. And that's an interesting, you know, story of the difference between the two. And again, it comes down to personal taste.
Yeah, and that's an amazing for her to see it back in its condition that her grandfather left it. You know, you left an heirloom as an heirloom, and 50, 100 years from now, I bet it still looks the way it does now.
I totally agree with that. Yeah, I do paint some machines that are, you know, so far gone that they're like, oh my gosh, it's a parts machine. You know, I take things that people probably consider parts machines and paint them, you know, do things like that with them. But I think probably what you're doing that I also do is something called a sympathetic restoration, where you leave some of the patina on it and you kind of get it back working. And it doesn't look like it rolled off of the showroom floor, but it has wear and it has shows its age, but it's working.
And they can actually use it too. I mean, for me, and I don't know, Scott, how you feel, but and I agree with your preservationist perspective. But for me, I love to use a typewriter. I don't want to have a typewriter restored and then put in a closet or a display case for the next 100 years. But what is your thought?
The late Steve Dade really helped me with that one. He was the sort of the Corona king. And as I sent him pictures of it because I needed new rubber and there was some issues with it. And he was the one who said to me, I have to tell you, he said, that has italic typeface. And he said, and he was a big Corona 3 collector. He said, in all the Corona 3s I've had, I've only seen one with italic typeface, and I own it. And I spent a lot of money for it. He said, so that is a pretty, you know, unique machine. So it's not something that would have been issued by the Army. It was a special order machine. And so he was able to give me a little bit of more, you know, input into the machine. And that's one of the things I find in the community when I, you know, talk to people or when I trade typewriters, or there's so many resources out there. I'm very, you know, very good friends with Lucas Duell, and he is incredible when it comes to these early 1800s machines. I was very, very lucky to strike up a friendship with John Lavery in Australia. I don't know if you two know him.
Yes. Love John.
So John and I were going back and forth, and I started buying some old typewriter tools. And knowing what they are is one thing, but knowing how to use them is another. So I would send John a picture and I'd say, okay, I know this is a typewriter tool, you know, tell me how to use it and what to do, and more importantly, what not to do with it. And he was great. And he would write me back and he would say, you know, these are three prong players, or these are nine prong players, or these are this. And he would say, you know, be very careful when you're doing this on German machines, because the metal is very, very brittle and it will break, or be very careful if you do this. And he went back and forth with me. And so I sort of have this little document that I had of a picture of the machine or the tool, and then his description of everything. And it was great to go back and forth with him. And we became sort of pen pals, even though we had never met. And then at one point, I had an old tool case, typewriter tool case that I had. And John said to me, geez, I'd love one of those. You want to do a trade? And I said, well, sure, what do you have? And he said, I have a 1950s Halda. And I was like, oh, my God, I've been looking for one of those. So we did a trade. I sent him the tool case. He sent me the Halda. But the Halda was just this great machine. And I got it, and I went through it, and I got it back going. And he said to me, I don't even know where I got it from, but I've had it for like 15, 16 years. It's been sitting on a shelf. It needs, you know, something. So I went through it and got it working. And he was like, wow, you did a great job on that. And again, it was one of those things where, you know, I just preserved it. So getting that kind of information from a guy like that, who's in his 70s and who, you know, that's all he did all his life. He was a typewriter repair guy. So I said, you got to kind of mine that knowledge from people when you, you know, as you can, as you get going on it. And it's very interesting that there's so many people out there with so much talent in this community.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I see some of these young people that are as young as 15, 17, 18, 20 year olds, and they're able to strip down a machine and from that's in terrible condition and restore it back to it's like kind of like you do. And I guess I should say preserve it. And it looks amazing. And of course, then they turn around and sell it, which is fine because, you know, you want to make some money doing it if you can. And the outcome of so many more people that are repairing machines these days versus even 4 years ago when we got started as Austin Typewriter Inc. has just been an enormous, that's one of the, Everett and I were talking about, I think that's one of the things about the pandemic that's been a positive for the typewriter community is people have had time because they're at home.
And I've kind of, yeah, the pandemic was interesting. I kind of felt like a drug dealer. I would put money in a mailbox, grab a package from a front porch, and, you know, and one of the funny stories was I bought a Hermes Baby from 1964. I have a 64 Hermes 3000. So I was able to find a Hermes Baby down in Long Island. And this lady, it was like 3 hours from me. And this lady said to me, I'm not opening my door. I'm not doing anything. The typewriter will be in a box on the porch. Put the money in the mailbox and go.
Jeez.
Okay. And I drove down on a Sunday and, you know, literally pulled into her driveway, never shut the car off, put the money in the mailbox, took the typewriter and went. And so I've done a lot of those deals and it's been very interesting. One of my funnier stories also was one of my nicest standards that I have. It's the oldest machine I also have. It's a 1909 LC Smith number one in pristine shape. And it came with this big wooden case. And I got it from a guy down in New York. And he said, well, you know, he lived on Long Island, but he said, I work in the Bronx. So if you want to come down on a Saturday, you can get it. I said, great. So I was on my way down there and I was literally 5 minutes from where he was. And this guy runs a stop sign and T-bones me and just spins my car around and have all this damage to the car. And, you know, but we both survived. The good news was that, you know, I got the machine and I said to the guy, can you tell me a little bit about this machine? And he related that his uncle was in the military his entire life and carried this machine with him. He was in World War One and World War Two, and he had this wooden case built for it, and it had been in the family, and it ended up at his brother's house. And he said, my brother and I are just not typewriter guys. My uncle's passed away. Sadly, he had all this historical documents that he had typed on this typewriter and letters which were destroyed in a fire. So when I got the machine, I looked at it, and it was just amazing, in amazing condition. It had the L.C. Smith from Syracuse, New York, number one, right across the front. And it looks like a brand-new machine. And the case that he had was, you know, custom-built for a big wooden case. So when I get things like that, they immediately sort of go in my collection, and I say I want to keep those versus turning around and selling them. But I always find that typewriters that have a story to them mean a lot to me.
Just and one question I have to know is, though, you had a T-bone accident. You continued forward on that after that accident to pick this up?
I did. I called the guy and I said, you know, listen, some guy just ran a stop sign, T-boned me. And he's like, well, I'm 5 minutes. So I said, all right. So the police are there taking a report. And he comes over and he's like, I'm really sorry. What do you want to do? I said, well, I'm here. You got the typewriter. I got the money. Let's do the deal. So we did then. And the cops were kind of looking at us like, okay, what's going on here?
doing a drug deal.
We said, this is a big typewriter. And he was like, okay.
You're like the Tony Soprano of typewriters.
I love it.
But I love those typewriters that I acquired that have a story. And if I could just share one other one with you.
Sure.
Yeah, please.
I got a Smith Corona Skywriter from a very young man. And he met me down in a town right next to mine. And I went down there and I looked at it and it was like pristine shape. And I said, what's the story? And he said, this typewriter belonged to my grandmother's best friend. And she worked at Smith Corona. Mm-hmm. And when she passed away, she had no family. She gave the typewriter to my grandmother to, as a present. And she said, just watch over my typewriter. And he said, now both of my grandparents have passed away and I'm cleaning out their house and I just don't know what to do with it. So I said, okay. So I took the typewriter and I did some research and she had with a little 1960s label maker put her name on the case, the metal case. And I looked it up. And I did some research, and sure enough, there was her obituary online, and it said she had worked her entire life for Smith Corona in Syracuse. And so I did the math, and I said, so this woman was 35 years old, working for Smith Corona in 1953. She bought this Skywriter, and I pondered, like, why did she buy a Skywriter? What was the allure? What did she write on it? What was her life like? And her obituary was just very, very small. And as I looked at the typewriter, I said, it's in amazing condition. And she kept it, until she died in her late 80s. And so the typewriter had to have some meaning to her and some connection to her. And I always wonder with those. So that's in my collection. And I always find those stories when you get those typewriters that have that human connection to them. I say, boy, I wonder about those people and wonder what the story is with them. And it amazes me. You find an old receipt, a typewriter case, that somebody bought it brand new. And I have several of those that people said, oh, my father bought it for me when I went to high school or college. And they have that human, human condition, human touch with it.
Yeah. And I think in a lot of cases, and when stories like you've been telling, it's kind of like a pocket watch, for example. Somebody had it for years and years, passed away, and their widow or widower kept it in their household because it was a memory. I mean, that's something that they saw every single day.
Yeah. I mean, I'm working right now on a 1950s Smith Corona Silent, and I opened up the case, and it has the original receipt from September 26th of 1953. And the total balance was $83.19 back then for this typewriter. It was, the retail price was $103. And they had a little payment card on the back of, how much they paid every week on it. And it just amazes me that people would keep that stuff, and just throw it in the case. And I find a lot of that stuff when I was able to get an old Burroughs Standard, which you don't see them a lot. And they were mainly an adding machine company, but they did have, they made some typewriters. And the lady that I bought it from, her dad was an accountant at Burroughs, and it was his personal typewriter and just sat at the house. And so I love those stories when I can take a machine and put it to a name or a face or a story.
And it makes it part of your collection story. So I want to jump backwards a little bit because you talked in the early part of the podcast about how you had published two books. Can you expand a little bit on that, if you like?
Sure. I wrote two books. The first one was called The Reporter's Intuition, and it's about a reporter who stumbles onto a plot to assassinate a U.S. senator by a renegade faction of the IRA. And the second one is called Fatal Error. And it's about a publicist who is living in a little community in the country, and she starts being stalked online, and she has no idea why or who it is.
And are these available online?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, and a paperback. They're both mystery novels, and so it's always fun. And I wrote both of those on the computer, and I find that I write better on a typewriter. I write, you know, I journal, I write short stories. I write a lot of letters. And once I started writing on a typewriter, it became so much more of a different feel and slows you down, makes you think a little bit more. But I also love the feeling of it.
And talk a little bit about the feel, though. I mean, because there's a lot of young people that we have in our community, typewriter community, who are writers or thinking about, you know, becoming writers and want to do something besides writing with a pen or a computer. What suggestions, since you have that experience, would you give to somebody in terms of using a typewriter?
When I sit down at a computer and I start to write, it's too easy, which is a thing with all of technology today. It makes it too easy to get distracted. We have an attention span of 3 seconds. So you type that first line and you say, oh, I'm going to just check my email, or something pops up, or you get an instant message, and you're connected to the outside world through that computer. Where with a typewriter, when you sit down, you're not connected to anything but that typewriter. And it's that sort of that tactile experience of I sit down and I hit a key and, you know, a type bar comes up and it makes connection, and it slows down the process when I'm writing, so that I have to sit and think. And I when I'm typing on a computer, you know, I get the squiggly line. Oh, you spelt this wrong. Oh, this is... When I take time to correct that, I've sort of lost that train of thought in there. Where on a typewriter, when I sit down, I don't care if I've misspelled something. I don't care if I don't have a period or a comma there, or if the grammar's not right. It's getting it down. It's getting it down on, you know, and I tend to go through and write till I'm done with that day. And then I'll go through and I'll make all my little editorial corrections and go back and do it. It takes longer, but in the end, I think it's worth it.
So are you currently working on another novel at all?
I am. I'm writing I'm almost finished with it. I'm doing a collaboration with a friend of mine, and we are writing about a young guy who finds a guitar at an estate sale, and he has no idea where it came from. It just looks like it's been burnt and smells of smoke. And so we go back and forth, and we discover that the guitar belonged to someone who was lynched back in the 30s, who was a black blues musician. And it's the story of that, how he finds it and how he goes back with it. And so he's done all his writing on the computer, and he'll send it to me. I do all mine on typewriter. And like I said, I go through, I edit it all up, and then I put it in the computer and send it to him. But for me, I write letters to people. David, you and I correspond.
Yes.
Back and forth. And, you know, I write letters, I do journals, and I use different machines. I rotate all my machines through, and I use them all the time for different things.
Is there an era that of machines, like from a decade that you really gravitate toward?
For me, I'm sort of a fan of the 20s to like the 50s. Not that I don't love all machines, but some machines just don't sort of sparked my interest. And I'll give an example. I once found a Blickensderfer number 4, and I think it was only the third one ever to be found. And I had a typewriter, was selling it for a lady, bringing it to her on a Sunday, a little bit early. And I said, I got some time to kill, and I drove by a place that was having a tag sale. So I spun around and I said to the woman, you got any old typewriters? Because they never put typewriters out. I always have to ask them. And she said, well, yeah, there's one in the garage. And I went in, and it was an old Underwood number 3. And I said, do you have anything else? She said, well, I have one in the cellar, but I don't think you'd want it because it's broken and it's in a wooden case and it says 4. And so I was immediately thinking of like a Corona 4. So I said, well, let me take a look at it. And her husband brings it up and opens the case, and my jaw dropped. And so I ended up making a deal with them and taking the typewriter, and I came home and I couldn't find much on the 4. So I emailed Richard Polt and said, you know, got this machine. I can't find anything about it on a typewriter database or anywhere else. And he said, well, there's only like 2 or 3 of them that have been found.
So there's a good reason that there's no information on it.
Yeah. And he said, he said, from what you're showing me, and I sent him all the pictures, he said, it looks like it was probably between, you know, the 1890s, but he said the four were used mainly in telegraph offices because they only had capital letters and a number wheel. And in this wooden case, there was an extra wheel, all the tools that came with it, and an instruction sheet. So Richard said to me, you know, if you have the instruction sheet that's specific to the four, it's probably the only one in existence because I don't think I've ever seen another one. So I said, yes, it's in here. It's thumbtacked on the top of the case. So that was, you know, that was just one of those lucky finds. And it ended up that I ended up selling it to a collector and who collects Blickensderfers. And it was, again, a beautiful machine, not my thing. And so I said, well, you know, I think someone should be able to benefit from that. I recently picked up last week Calligraph number 2, which is from the 1890s, and beautiful machine, works, types, everything. And I found a gentleman in upstate New York, way up for me, that collects them, and he's interested. So that's going out to him. So I mainly stick to the 20s to the 50s.
In the styles from, I know you're a car guy. So is there, and from the 20s to the 50s, there was definitely a jump, a change in thought and of the time, and there's kind of a parallel in cars as well. Is it? Do you have any thoughts on how from the 20s to the 50s typewriters evolved as far as their physical for their skin, their cladding?
Yeah, one of the main things that I've always seen was, if you look at pre-war versus post-war, pre-war, those machines were very much influenced by Art Deco. They were works of art, you know, high gloss, lacquer paint, you know, beautiful decals, glass top keys, duotone colors. I mean, I have several 1920s to 30s Royal Model P's. I mean, those are just works of art. And I have a 1925 Royal 10, you know, it's a beautiful looking machine. It looks like a work of art. And then when you get to the post-war era, it's almost like everything is utilitarian, like it was left over from the war. Drab colors, browns, Bakelite green keys, sort of that desert sand color. Doesn't make you go, ooh. I mean, they're great functioning machines, but it doesn't look like a work of art like some of the earlier machines do. And that was on purpose, because I think the war effort, when people were coming out of the war, it was similar to cars. You know, cars that were, you know, came out in the late 40s before 1950, they were sort of a regurgitation of the cars from 1940 that went into the war. So the real sort of new styles didn't come out till the mid-50s. But as far as typewriters go, you know, people sort of refer to what are the grails as the, you know, 1948 Royal Quiet Deluxe, the Dreyfus model. But again, that's a, you know, black and gray, muted colors. And I've read some history on that where apparently he did a study where he talked to secretaries. The reason he made them in those colors is because they said the high gloss colors, when the sun hit the typewriters in the afternoon from certain offices, it would glare up in their face and they, you know, this blinding glare. So he muted everything down. But if you look at Smith Coronas, Royals, Underwoods from that time, they're, you know, dull browns, dull grays, dull blacks, versus if you look at those same ones from the 1920s and 30s, they're really beautiful typewriters. I mean, Everett, I think you and I exchanged an Underwood 4-bank, an orange one that I sent you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I've got that machine, and I actually have another one coming that is identical to that, too. I've got a thing for bright red machines for Coronas, Underwoods, and Royal P's myself.
As we're sitting here, he's actually brought his beautiful Corona 4. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a Corona 4 that is in just pristine shape that I've gone through, and it works like a champ. And so there's something about these machines and the early colors, and they're more about the object almost in a way. They're beautiful objects. Whereas I totally agree with you that there seems to be something when they went kind of that dull color, that they were more about what the function was, and they were, you know, they were tools to, they weren't functioning on the graph. They were, they're the style and the shape and everything, but there's definitely this change in a philosophy change in what these machines were doing.
Well, to me, when I see these machines from that period, it reminds me so much of the shows that you watch. Like, just to go to the grocery store, you would wear a suit or a beautiful dress and nice shoes, and everything was polished and it's gorgeous. Whereas, like today, you know, people go to the store right. In their pajamas.
Yes. And I just finished a 1936 Corona Special, black and red one. And it's just an absolutely beautiful machine. And when I got it, the paint was in faded, but the paint was in beautiful shape. So as I brought it back, it's that piano black lacquer, and the front panel has that red with a gold Corona Special on it.
I know which one you're talking about.
It's just a work of art. I mean, it's got the glass top, you know, the chrome ring keys. And when I look at that machine, it's just kind of stunning. I also have, which is one of my favorite ultra portables, I have a 1924 Underwood 3-bank. I think Everett and I, we kind of were talking about this. I had bought a Underwood 3-bank, and it was trashed. And I ended up sending it to Everett because I said, it's just, you know, I can't get it to work.
Yep.
So he took that, and then I found this one, and I sent him a picture and said, okay, what do you think? And he was like, well, it looks good. You know, it looks like it came from an estate sale. So I ended up buying it, and when I got it, it was really incredible. And it was the only machine that I really taken to another person to fix it. I brought it down to Gramercy Typewriter in New York. And I had Jay go through that. And Jay and I have become very, very good friends. And I bought, you know, several machines from him. But I had Jay go through it, and I was having trouble getting the tension because it's got the... You know, it's got a number lock and a cap lock, and the carriage raises twice. So I was having trouble getting the right tension on the spring, and I never didn't compare it to. But he went through it and said to me, this is one of the cleanest, nicest Underwood 3-banks I've ever seen. And it's just, they're just such great machines, but it's like a work of art when you look at it. You look at the design and the keys and how they laid out the keys and the paint on it. It's just a beautiful work of art. Where if you look at a 1955 or 50s Smith Corona Silent or Super or Skywriter, you know, great machines. They type wonderfully. They're like a tank. They'll go forever. But much more of a aesthetically non-pleasing machine.
This question I'm about to ask is maybe impossible to answer because you're not there. But when you talk about what you just described, think about the people that actually worked on those and built these things back in those time periods. Do you think that the manufacturers, the employees who actually put all these together, had a certain mindset compared to, like, you know, 25 years later and the types of machines put together?
Well, I think the designers did, not necessarily the manufacturers. When I think of... I'll see pictures, you know, online, and people say, oh, this is a rare old typewriter. And I say, you know, Underwood rolled one a minute off the assembly line. It's like a Model T, you know, right. A Model A. When I had a 1930 Model A pickup, and people would say, that's rare. And I'd say, no, it's old. It's not rare. They made 4 million of them.
Right.
So, you know, so there's a definite difference when I see those ads and people say, oh, it's rare. I say, well, it's not really rare. It's just, you know. It's old, but the people that designed them back in the 30s, that whole design period was really around Art Deco, the buildings, you know, the windows. I mean, anything you look at that's Art Deco, and you look at a 1930s like Royal, and I have a 1929 Royal P with Vogue typeface, and it's just a gorgeous machine, as are all the Royal P's from that period. So the designers, I think, were taking really heavily from that Art Deco period. And when everything around 1940 to 41 switched to war production, it became, how do we make this utilitarian? So cars were olive drab. You know, all of the machinery that we think of back then, the only really new thing that came out after the war was the television. But if you look at the old radios, they were even Art Deco until... you know, post-war, they kind of then had that utilitarian look. So a lot of that, I think, was just the people that manufactured them, you know, were just bakelite keys were sort of new. And but if you look at the Smith Coronas, the Royals of that time, the 48 Royal Quiet Flux, it's a beautiful machine, but it's kind of a very muted black and gray, and it still has the, you know, the chrome keys on it, which are great. But the, but as time went on, I think they just got more and more the sort of utilitarian rather than saying, oh, this is a style. And back then, in the 30s, as you, if you look at some of the old ads, they were really saying to people, hey, this is a new thing, so to speak. Because if you think about standards, most of the standards that when they came out in the 20s were in businesses, newspapers. They weren't really for home production. When they started getting them into home production, it was like, hey, we got to make this pretty to get it into people, get people to buy it. Got to have some eye candy to get it into people's homes. What does the consumer want to buy this for? And I think that's what they really went out for. And they had these great looking machines that people just flocked to in droves.
Absolutely. I know the Corona, I'm not the Corona, the Royal P ads from that time were all about colors for the home and trying to sell it to the idea of the typewriter in the home to the women and the children who were getting an education, and also the stereotypical nuclear family that was going on at the time.
I mean, one of my favorite machines that I have is a 1938 Royal Deluxe, and it's burgundy and chrome.
Ooh.
And I got it from an online sale, but it came from an estate sale. So when I got it, I put all the rubber on it, and it just is probably one of my favorite typers. It just is, it's amazing how beautifully it types, but that burgundy and chrome, it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you on that.
It's a machine that I say, you know, everybody has that kind of desert island machine. And, you know, I have a Hermes 3000. I have, you know, I have Royal Peas with Boga. But that 38 Deluxe is sort of the wow. It has that wow factor. You know, it's got the chrome band around it, got the burgundy on it, and it's just a great machine.
Yep, there is something really interesting about. There's a sweet spot in the time period, in the timeline, where, you know, in the early 1900, 1900, no portables. 1910, they started thinking about it. 1920s, the portables were really in full going by that time. People were trying to figure it out. The 1930s, there was this little sweet spot that was happening about that time with the different manufacturers, and they were. There was something they really hit on, I think, at that time that is really that there's the beauty and the function that happens at that period that just really kind of magic. That's why I agree with you on the Underwood 3 Bank. The Underwood, I think I may have 6 of them that all have all new rubber that I've done. I keep finding them that are I've got some pretty minty ones that I think they probably, a couple of them had their spools lost early on in their life, and then they weren't used, so they're in mint condition. But there's something about that little sweet spot in there in the time that's pretty amazing. That there was kind of a magic time at that point.
Yeah, the Royal. I have 3 Royal Ps that, you know, one of them has Vogue from 1929, but I was able to find a couple years ago an early 1927 model, and that is just an incredible typer. I mean, that to me is, you know, it has such a beautiful feel to it and a beautiful touch to it. And it's just basic black with the Royal logo on the front, the Royal logo on the paper tray. It's just like, wow, and those machines, the thing that I with all my machines, I say the same thing. When you can take a machine that's 80 or 90 or 100 years old, put a little bit of work into it and make it function like the day that it came off the assembly line, you know, that's a testament to the engineering and design work back then.
Well, the good thing about the Royal P, which I've discovered just having known Eric for a few years, is that they're so easy to work on. I mean, I found one, we were talking about this a couple of weekends ago, where I found one here in Austin maybe 3 years ago, and it was in rough condition, and he turned it into a parts machine. And he literally, a couple of weeks ago, had stripped it down, bought some Tupperware divider deals, and has got all the screws and pieces and parts. But that machine has revived probably how many?
At least a dozen. Because it's like, I know there have been people call me and say, hey, Everett, do you have a piece for this or that? And I'm like, sure, I've got it. I'll send it to you for, you know, what the mailing costs for, yeah, for the most part.
You even sent a little, what was it, the base screw for up to Greg Motto up in Canada. Yeah, but that's all he needed to make his machine whole again.
Absolutely.
And that's the beauty of some of these, you know, machines. And I, you know, I think maybe the exception to the pre versus post war is if you look at like a 46, 47 Smith Corona, the Silent, the Clipper, the Sterling, those are really, I think, breathtaking machines too, even though they have that matted black, but they have the chrome keys and, you know, they're just really, really nice typers. I sort of, when I started getting into collecting, I got caught up a bit into the Hermes 3000 fever, as everyone does. And said, oh, I really want one of these. And everyone I looked at online, I said, boy, it's, you know, just outrageously expensive. So that was one machine that I decided if I was going to buy one, I was going to buy it totally done. And I bought one from Gramercy Typewriter in New York City. And the day I went down to pick it up, it was like picking up a new car. You know, I was like, sat down at it and I'm like, oh my god, they recondition these machines and they're like brand new, all new rubber on it. It's just, and that's again another one of my favorite typers. It's from 1964, but it's just a beautiful, you know, example of engineering. And you know, if you look at the Olympias and the Hermes, they're way over engineered compared to a Smith Corona or a Royal in terms of the way they did margins and this, but they're just beautiful machines and they type so flawlessly.
I love how you described it as the experience of like buying a new car. Cause one of the things I love is when people put video online and you see newbies typing on it for the first time, especially a machine that's in good working condition that somebody's actually been able to work on and put new rubber, whatever. And the look on their face is like a new car. They get so excited when they hit that key for the first time or write their name or a sentence. It's just an amazing experience.
And I have that. My niece has two twin daughters, and they wanted a typewriter. So I got them a little Skywriter, and I went through it and did it all. And I brought it over, and it was so funny as I'm showing them how to work it, and they're typing, and they're fascinated until the carriage gets to the end. And they're like, now what? Where's the enter key? And I take the return arm and I pull it, and it was like their eyes lit up like it was magic. So it's sometimes great showing, you know, young people that have they've just grown up with, you know, everything electronic and digital to show them how something mechanically works.
Oh, I agree. I was over at my friend's house over the weekend, and her son, who I gifted a typewriter almost a year ago, but it was a Smith Corona Super Silent, but I was figuring since he uses it, I wanted to change out the ribbon and show him I gave him an extra ribbon just in case, but he did not, he had never taken it out of the case.
Oh no.
Cause he didn't know how to do it. And I had showed him, but right. They just forgot. So they were amazed that it actually came out of the case itself. But then I was showing him some other things they had just never done, like the margin release. They had the MR. Well, he thought that was Mr. He didn't know. He had no idea what the MR was. And so he was so excited that when he got, you know, when you get to the end of the margin, it doesn't work anymore. He would just skip the word and go to the other side like he would do on end of a page of paper. But he didn't realize if he had the margin release, he could have finished the word T-H-E instead of just putting T. But it's just those little bitty things that we take for granted.
Right, like knowing the number one is the lowercase L and an exclamation point is a period, backspace, apostrophe.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like, oh my god.
But it's amazing how these young kids today are able to understand. He was using the letter I, the capital I, as the number one, so at least he was able to look at it in a way and go, well, that could be a one.
Sure. And I started, when I first started repairing them and I started selling them and stuff, I ended up winding my own ribbons, which was also an art that I never thought I would do. And you know, a lot of typewriters have a little grommet in the end so that it trips the ribbon reverse. Well, right. A lot of people you'll see when they do they wind a ribbon, or they don't have that in there, you know. And I sort of went that extra step and said, well, when I sell a typewriter that has that feature, I'll put the grommet in. I bought a little tool to do that. And so it was very interesting. And this friend of mine over in Troy, like I said, he kind of taught me all that stuff, which was amazing for me to learn from him. Now he's about my age, but one of the things that was great was he told me, when he got into the typewriter business, he was the new kid on the block. And he said, I had to work on all the IBM Selectrics because I was the new kid. And he said, my dad had all these other techs who they worked on all the old stuff, and they wouldn't even touch those Selectrics. But he said there was, you know, a guy there that could type or could solder a, you know, a type head onto a type slug, onto a type bar. And he said he could hit it the first time, every time. And he said, I tried it. I made such a mess. It wasn't even funny. But he said this was it was back in a time when that was the trade and that's what they did. And that's why I was very fortunate when I talked to John Lavery, and he would say, be careful when you use this tool, or be careful when you do this, or don't do this. So that's a fading art. And I think a lot of those people that we are in our community, if you can mine that knowledge from them, you know, it's great to learn how to, oh, I'm going to wind a ribbon, or I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. And a lot of the things that I've had issues with, you know, I'll sometimes send Everett an email and say, okay, what am I missing here? You know? And it's as simple as, you know, he wrote me back once. I don't know if you remember ever, but there was something out of time, and you were like, it's this little piece here. Just bend it.
And oh, I'm, yeah. It's the escapement on the Royal Peas. I've got one pulled apart. And so if the escapement is not perpendicular to the machine, which what happens is the right platen knob gets whacked. And so it bends that whole carriage a little bit inside there. And so if it's not perpendicular with the machine, that's the first clue that you can just take and just bend it perpendicular. And usually it'll pop right back. Usually it's a magic.
It's that kind of stuff that just, you know, that really, really, you know, I'm thankful to be able to do that. And with, you know, with the orange underwood, I bought it, and it was, you know, I don't accept defeat on a lot of machines, but that one really just beat me. And I said to Everett, you know what, you want this, you know, make me an offer. And he was like, no, I got enough. I got too many. I'm like, okay. And then like 2 weeks later, he's like, all right, I'll take it.
I thought about it a little longer.
So when y'all bend it or forming it, or are you bending it? Using a tool?
The correct word is probably forming it, but you're bending the metal back.
Are you using a tool to do that, or are you using might?
Yeah, I was able to find, thank God, through a lot of tag sales and a lot of looking, some really specific typewriter tools from people, and I found some down at this lady in New Jersey. Had one. Her dad was a typewriter repair guy, and so they were selling a lot of stuff, and they had already sold a lot, but she had old toolboxes that he had that had just, you know, regular screwdrivers and plumbing wrenches, but he had typewriter tools mixed in there. So she allowed me the ability, this was during the pandemic, to go to her house, go to her front porch, and just sort through all these tools. Wow. And pick out stuff that I knew was, you know, he had type benders. And he had stuff that was specific to Olivetti's, because he was he worked for Olivetti and he worked for Olympia for a while. But he had some specific stuff, so I was able to get some really, you know, some nice benders and that type of stuff. But again, you know, you get that and you say, okay, what I know what this is. I got a tool catalog and it tells me, but how do I use it without doing too much, you know, without doing damage? And that's really where people's experience comes in.
One other question I had, and because you are a writer, what is on your desk to use when you write? I mean, what are your go-to machines?
Well, the last book that I was working on, I used a Royal 10, and I had a Royal 10 that I had with the dual windows in the side, and had a friend of mine who was a doctor who did me a favor and helped me out with some stuff, and he wanted an old typewriter, and so I gifted him that one, and then I went out and got another Royal 10, because I love those. I think between those and the Underwoods, the Royal 10's my favorite. And I know people will say, oh, like a Royal KMG is the ultimate standard. They are, but to me, they kind of look like a tank, where the Royal 10 just has an aesthetic look to it. It's just got sweeping lines, and it's really nice. So for the last novel, I use that. For short stories, you know, I'll use a Hermes 3000. I use that quite a bit. Letters, you know, I'll typically pick. I have a beautiful 1964 Olympia SM4 that has cursive typeface. So I'll use that, or I'll use a Royal. I kind of rotate through when I'm writing letters, different machines. And then journaling, I journal every day. I use that Royal Deluxe 38, the burgundy one.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift.
It's fun to have a lot of typewriters, though. You got to admit, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Because you go, what am I in the mood to use today? You know, I'm a musician, and it's sort of like an instrument. You know, I pick up something, and I say, well, I might use this guitar to play jazz, but I wouldn't use it for heavy metal. And I would use this guitar to play blues, but not, you know. So it's great to have all these different machines that you can use. My rule is I try to keep it to 25 machines. And I know people say, oh, my God, are you out of your mind? You know, because I got 250, some people will say. But for me, I keep it to 25. And my rule is that if I buy one that I'm going to keep, something else has to go. Love the machines that I have to keep them.
Yeah, one in, one out, as I hear that a lot from people. Let's talk about, when you talk about feel, let's switch a little bit and talk about music, because you mentioned guitar. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm a musician. I was sort of a bass player by trade. I started playing when I was 9 years old. I played guitar, bass, and I sing. And I picked up the guitar because my brother, who is absolutely tone deaf, my parents sort of gave him anything he wanted in terms of lessons. He was, you know, a roller skater. He rode horses. He did all this stuff and really never stuck to one of them. But one of his things is he wanted to learn to play the guitar, and they bought him a guitar, and he was tone deaf, and it sat in the corner until one day I picked it up and said, And I had a cousin who was a guitar player, and he showed me one chord. And then from there, I taught myself. And so I was a self-taught musician and continue to play till today. And every instrument that I have, you know, has a different feel and a different use to it. And some instruments I pick up and I just, you know, I'll play them for months and then I'll put it down and won't touch it again. And, you know, but I play every day. It's sort of like with typewriters. You know, I may not use a certain machine for 2 or 3 months, and then I'll use that machine, you know, for a month or 2 months steady. And I find that when I rotate them through, you know, I get on a little bit of a kick now and then. Like a couple months ago, I was using the Corona 3 Bank, and then I was comparing it to the Underwood 3 Bank, you know, and they're both very different machines, even though they're 3 banks, sort of the same, you know, same era, but they both have a different feel. They both have a different touch to them. And, you know, it's cool to be able to have those at your disposal.
Definitely. And I'm going to switch back again to typewriter repairs, since we started off talking about your shop and everything, and you referenced that you sell to people all across the country. One of the big topics that we always hear about, and it just kills me when I see photos of this in either ATI or even in the ATC group or just people's personal pages, is getting it from like Shop Goodwill or some other eBay site. And somebody doesn't package a typewriter after you've just paid $200-$300 for it, and it comes to their home, you know, in multiple pieces. Talk a little bit about how the proper method of shipping a typewriter should be.
Well, I had some good experiences and some bad experiences with both USPS, UPS, FedEx. Lately, I have switched in the last couple of years to using FedEx exclusively for a couple of reasons. One is that they have a good track record of getting machines to people and not breaking them and not having issues with them. The other is that they will pick up at my house. And I've had one issue where a typewriter that did arrive damaged when I submitted a claim. They were very, very prompt at helping me out with that. And so I was able to refund money to the customer when they refunded money to me. But what I typically do on a portable machine, because it's obviously in a case, is when I'm getting ready to ship the machine, I shrink wrap the entire machine before it goes in the case. So everything in the typewriter itself, I shrink wrap so that everything is really tight on the machine. I then put it in the case. I'll put some bubble wrap inside the case. I then wrap the case 3 times each way with bubble wrap. Then I take my box and I'll put bubble wrap or styrofoam inside the box as a base layer, put the bubble wrap case in top of that. And then I'll put more bubble wrap or more styrofoam in, and then tape everything up. Now the Calligraph I just sold is getting shipped on Tuesday. Now that's a big standard machine, and so even though it came with a wooden case, the case was meant to sit on top of a table, so I had to do both of those separately. But again, it's tough when you're sending standards, because you really have to wrap those. So those typically what I'll do is, if I'm shipping those, and I don't ship a lot of them, but I will shrink wrap the entire machine, then I will bubble wrap the entire machine with small bubble wrap, and then wrap it again with large bubble wrap, and then usually wrap it like in a blanket or an old towel. And just, you know, I write fragile all over the boxes 100 times so that, you know, hopefully they'll see it.
Yeah, I tend to double box myself. I'll put a lot of cushion inside the box, describing the same way you type wrap it. I do the same thing. But then I'll tend to put the smaller box into a larger box with additional cushion, just, you know, because I've received some typewriters where the box is only in the one box, and it's got a big gash in it or something. And I thought, man,
yep,
I just need an extra layer of protection so that I don't have to worry about doing any kind of a refund or anything like that.
The most common mistake, I think, that I see people do that aren't familiar with typewriters is they put the typewriter in the case upside down.
Well, I think a lot of that has to come to do. I've seen a lot of newbies. I shouldn't call people newbies, but I did. People who are new into typewriters who think, oh, I'm going to flip this stuff because I see the price is $400 or $500 and I got this for free. And they'll stick it in just like you described, and mail it off thinking, hey, I just made $500. And then the person gets it on the other end and is irate because they just spent $500 and their machine's in 37 pieces.
And that's one of the, you know, to that point, I think, that's one of the things that sort of infuriates me when I, you know, read ads, whether it's Facebook Marketplace, eBay, Shop Goodwill, Craigslist. You know, people will say, oh, this is a great typewriter. It works. It needs a new ribbon. And I look at it and I say, you know, no one's touched it, you know. So what I do when I get a machine is, before I sell it, I take the body off the machine, I take all the rubber out of the machine, I clean the entire machine chemically, I clean all the type slugs, I check for the on-shift motion, I check for the on-feet motion. I'm going to go through the whole machine, make sure the ribbon reverse works, make sure the bell works, you know, clean underneath it, clean inside of it, you know, clean the body, bring the paint back to life. If the rubber is really, really that bad, you know, I'll replace it and put brand new rubber on it from JJ Short. And, you know, make sure I'll do all the chrome, put everything back together, test it again, put a new ribbon in it, you know, and that, so, and I even redo the cases, you know, make sure the cases are clean and they look good. So I take a lot of pride in doing it, and it takes a lot of work. And sometimes, you know, I see these machines online that are $400 or $500, like you said, $600. And I say, nobody's touched that machine. And somebody literally has just punched the key and said, oh yeah, it works, but it needs a new ribbon.
Yeah, I've seen that quite a bit as well. And you have a machine that's been completely restored for sale for $500 or $600, and then somebody thinks that, you know, this machine is now worth $500 or $600, and they're completely different. You know, it doesn't work, you know, like you're saying, and so it's hard to for people to understand that two machines sitting side by side have completely different values, but because one works and one doesn't.
Right, and
I've had some in shipping where, like, I had a one that I sold a little while ago. It was a Brown Quiet Deluxe, which you don't see those much, and everything worked when it left here. And when it got to the lady who bought it, she said, you know, the bell doesn't work. And so I walked her through, you know, I said, maybe it got bent in shipping or whatever, but there's a little striker on the back. And I kind of, and it was like 2 seconds. She's like, oh my God, it works. This was like a detective story. This was fun to work, you know, get to. So, you know, I'll help people out if I do send them a machine and say, you know, I've tested, I've gone through everything and it works. But when I see people that put them online and, you know, they're asking outrageous amounts of money, I said, it gives a bad name to everybody in the typewriter community when you buy something and they say, oh, this is, or I've seen them online where people have said, use the term refurbished. And I've emailed people, and because I look at the pictures and, you know, we can all tell. So what was done? Does it have new rubber? Oh, no, I just sprayed some Simple Green on it and cleaned it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's not refurbished. Did you take the body off? No. Did you test it? No. Or I've seen them where they say the carriage, you know, just moves back and forth. Okay, well, probably the drawband's broken. Did you replace the drawband? Now, if you're selling that machine for $50, well, that's one thing. But if you're asking $450, that's a totally other piece that's, for me, hard to swallow. And, you know, I'll tell people, I always try to be honest with people. If I see stuff on Facebook Marketplace or eBay that's, you know, they're asking an outrageous amount of money for, my line to them always is when people say in the ad, these are selling on eBay for X amount. And yeah. I always say, no, they're being listed on eBay.
Exactly.
What you have to do is you have to go in and look at the sold items and see what they've sold for recently. That's what they're selling for. And I'm you know, very upfront with people. And I'll say, you know, geez, I'm looking at this machine in the pictures, and I could tell it's going to need a new platen. Well, that's, you know, $150, $200 by the time you get into new rubber and shipping and all that. So, you know, if I give you $300 for this machine, and I've now got to put $200-$300 in rubber into it and time, and, you know, I'm not making any money on it. So, you know, sometimes when you explain that to people, they go, oh, I didn't know you could do that anymore. I didn't know you could put new rubber on it. I didn't know it cost that much, because rubber really is the thing that's, I don't know if you agree, Everett, but it's the thing, it's the cost that's out of our hands because we have to ship it somewhere.
Absolutely. No, the rubber is actually the thing that makes the machine work. I mean, it's the feet that grip the table, that grip like bulldogs, and then you have the platen that's the magic part, and the rollers that contact it.
Especially the feed rollers, because a lot of times, I don't know how many people go, oh my God, I have this wonderful, beautiful machine, there's no cracks in the platen, but they won't feed the paper, or the paper's, you know, crooked as I type, and I'm like, did you just look at the one piece of rubber, or did you look at the entire machine? Right. Again, but they go, well, the guy on the thing said for $500 it was in perfect shape. I'm like, again, buyer beware, because you really need to. I always recommend to people buying your typewriter from collectors who at least have some experience working on them and that are selling them, or somebody like you who has created a shop where you can actually buy it. And, you know, you have a history of somebody who has experience in pulling a machine apart, as opposed to, oh, I got this from an estate sale for $10 and I'm going to sell it for $400. And then the buyers end up pissed off because, you know, they got something that's been sitting in the shed for the last 40 years.
Right.
Right, and I recently had a Voss, and it was an absolutely beautiful machine. And wherever it was stored, it had two separate feed rollers on each side, you know, one on each side, and there's three feed rollers, but they were literally melted. I think it had been in a hot, must have been an attic or somewhere, but they were just, it was like they were a gummy bear, you know, they were that texture. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I have to get new rubber on it. So I put all brand new rubber on it, which was not cheap because it was a 32-inch carriage. So when you ask the premium price for it, you know, yeah, I always specify to people, this has all brand new rubber. And that's a lot of money when you have to put that out, first of all, because you don't know if you're going to get it back. You hope you're going to get that investment back. But when you put new rubber on a machine, there's nothing like it. You know, I put new rubber on a machine. I said, my God, I can't believe how beautiful it types. New feet the same way. But it's a lot of work, and you have to know what you're doing when you do that, and you have to send it out to somewhere. It's not like, oh, I got an extra platen sitting around here, you know?
Exactly. Well, the rubber can be more costly than the machine most of the time.
And I try to explain to people that, especially that are looking for that one machine, that's the only one they're ever going to buy, because they're not necessarily collectors. And they say, well, why spend so much money on a typewriter that has all new rubber? And I'm like, look, you're buying a machine that's 70, 80 years old for one. Let's say they're buying it from the 20s and 30s. You have new rubber on there. And let's say it's for their daughter or son who's, you know, 15, 17 years old. I say you are never, for the rest of their lifetime, going to have to replace that rubber, probably, you know, unless they're heavy users.
I use the car analogy with people. You know, I say to them, would you get in a car that was manufactured in 1968, you know, and drive down the road with the same tires on it that came out of it? And they're like, well, God, no. Okay, there you go. It's rubber. It degrades over time. And there are some people, I get it, who will buy a machine from me who are not going to use it. I did a beautiful Alpine Blue Smith Corona Silent a few years ago for a guy. And it was just absolutely gorgeous shape. And I said to him, you're going to love the way this types. And he said, I'm not going to type on it. I'm an accountant. It's going in my office for a, you know, decoration. Oh, okay. You know, well, but I get it. What? And I had another friend of mine who I went to school with, and he's a lawyer. And he said, you know, I want a typewriter to display in my office, but I also want to use it from time to time to type on. And I said, okay, what do you want? And he said, well, you've known me since first grade. Pick something out and send it to me. Tell me what I owe you. And I said, okay. So I, you know, picked out this beautiful black Royal P that I thought would go nice. And all new rubber, and I sent it to him, and he was like, this thing is just unbelievable. I love this, you know? So it's all what people want to do with it. You know, if they get a family heirloom, I tell them, you know, you're going to use this, you're going to just put it as a decoration, or, you know, a lot of times people that have family heirlooms aren't going to type on them, but they do want them to look nice. So right. That's, you know, and I'm upfront with them about that. When they give it to me, I say, listen, you know, you get a Royal or an Underwood Standard and you want to put all new rubber on it, it's going to be a little bit costly. But if you're not going to use this, you know, if you're going to maybe type one or two letters on it, that's one thing. But if you want to sit down and type the Great American Novel, you know, you have to understand that you have hardened rubber with metal hitting. And that's, you know, that's an invitation for disaster down the road.
Okay, absolutely. And it's okay, though, for people who want to put it on display. You know, then it's the value of the typewriter may be the heirloom factor or the decoration factor. And like we've talked about on this podcast before, just in private with people, value is what somebody's willing to pay for it. And, you know, it just comes down to that factor of what it is you're going to use it for.
Exactly. And I always say that, you know, when, well, I don't care if you're talking about classic guitars or classic cars or classic typewriters, somebody says, geez, that is worth X. And I say, no, that's worth what someone's willing to pay for. That's really what it comes down to. It's how bad does somebody want that item to pay for it? Yeah, and that, yeah. What are they willing to do once they get it? You know, my Hermes 3000 was something that I said, I don't want to spend, you know, $300 for a Hermes 3000 online and get it and have to put a lot of work into it. So I'm going to buy one already done by, and when I went to Gramercy Typewriter, you know, to me, they're, you know, they just, I can't say enough good things about them. They're just, you know, incredible company. And I, you know, I called Jay and he was funny because he said to me, I got a few. What are you looking for, a specific typeface? You're looking for, I said, no, I'm looking for, you know, 60s. I want the curvy model. And we went back and forth. And since then, I've bought some machines from him that just are flawless, is the only way that I can, you know, say it. And so I always try to aim to that level and say, if I can take a typewriter, you know, and I can get it so that it, you know, use them as an example and say, when it goes out the door, everything's working on this thing, you know, and then my own machine's the same way. We, you know, we all take pride in our collections, and you know, when we get that one machine we don't like, we just send it to Everett.
Yeah. I have another question. Yeah, love it. You talk about Gramercy, and then there's other notable names that are across the country that have been in business for a long time. Some are now gone. What do you see for the future of Gramercy, and then with so many other people like yourself and others? We've got so many people that are doing it themselves, creating little shops across the country. But for the guys that have been doing it for such a long time, like Gramercy, what is the future of the typewriter repair business?
Well, it's funny. I talked to Jay a few months ago during the height of the pandemic, and they were only open, you know, limited hours, and they were hoping New York was going to open. And that's all since changed, you know, where they're getting more and more the ability more and more to open up more hours. And he's got a very small store. So they were only letting so many people in at a time. But he was telling me he's spending more and more of his time out on service calls out in the field. So he said, I had to hire a couple of people. One to, you know, work in the store and do sales, because I'm out doing a lot of service calls and a lot of repair work. So I think there's a lot of call for it. And their, you know, their draw, in my opinion, is the quality of the product you get there, whether you bring your typewriter in for repair or whether you go in to buy a new one. Now, they're, you know, they're about a two and a half hour trip for me if I drive down to New York City. For me, it's worth it, you know, because I love to go down there and spend time with him, and he's a friend, and you know, we talk, and I'll go back and forth on machines. But you know, they face the same thing where people come in and they want this repaired or that repaired, or they want a new machine. So I think there's a good market for people that have machines that want to be brought back to life or want to use them. And I have a good customer who during the winter kept me really in machines. He brought me, you know, 3 of the 40 Smith Corona models and said, geez, you know, I need to get these up and running. No rush on them. And I did. And then he had some Royal Peas, and then they were all machines that had some issues. And he said to me, I don't feel comfortable tackling these myself. I don't want to do more damage than good, so I'm giving them to you. And I said, okay. And I was able to get them all up and running for them. And, you know, they take some time to repair, and repair work is not the easiest thing in the world to do. It's easy to go and find a typewriter and say, oh, this looks pretty good, needs some cleaning, needs a little tune-up here and there. But when you get stuff that has some things that are majorly wrong with it, and you have to spend, you know, some hours digging into it and repairing it. So I think that future of the typewriter repair, and I see people like Lucas Duell in Chicago. Lucas does great, great repair work, you know, and he also does great restoration work when I see some of the typewriters that he puts up for sale. But he also is one of those breed that you were talking about earlier, David, young guys who are not afraid, or young girls who are not afraid to jump in. I mean, I see him rip apart like a Williams or a Hammond, and I'm just like, oh my God.
No, that's frightening to me. I'm the 20s, 30s guy, and I love that. I couldn't imagine ripping into a Hammond or a Williams. Yeah.
And they do it with such ease.
yes. And it's just this no fear. But the other piece of that is, you know, Lucas and I are very good friends, and we correspond all the time, but he's also into things that I don't consider retro, which shows my age. Like, he sent me an email one day and said, you know, hey, have you ever worked on a reel-to-reel tape recorder? I said, yes, I own, you know, tons of them over the years. And he's like, really? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm really dating myself right now.
Yeah, but he loves them. I saw his recently.
Yeah, or cassette players that he's into, that kind of thing. But, you know, that goes to the fact of, like I said, everybody has a different thing that they sort of specialize in and are good at. And I go to Gramercy sometimes, and I just am just blown away. You know, when I saw, I had not planned on buying the Olympia that I have. You know, it's a 1960 SM4 with cursive typeface, and I just saw a picture of it online that he had on Instagram with a bunch of other Olympias, and it was burgundy. I just had this soft spot for burgundy, and I was like, geez, Jay, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's got cursive typeface. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to have that, you know? So you just sometimes, you make those impulse buys.
Are there any machines that you have on, what we all have a list of, oh, I really want to touch one of those, or I want that in my collection. Are there any out there that you're looking for, or do they, what happens with me?
Well, yeah. When I first, as a writer, one of the first things that when I got into collecting, I wanted to have one of every typewriter that Ernest Hemingway had, because I'm a huge Hemingway fan. So I had the Corona 3. I got the Underwood 3 Bank. I got the Quiet Deluxe. And then finally, I got the Halda, which was the last one he used. So I've had all those. I do have a soft spot for those brown Quiet Deluxes that were made in, I think, only 41 and 42. They came with a special case that was only off for those years. You don't see them often. So I picked one up a while ago. I ended up selling it. But when they come up, I love Royal Peas, obviously. And those are the machines that I'm always sort of looking out for. I've had a couple of those Depression era portables. I don't know if you guys have ever had any of those.
Yeah, I do. I've got one of the, what do they call those? The juniors?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got one of those.
And they, you know, some of them came with just capital. Some of them came with no front frame. Some came, you know, no bell, no right margin. They were just stripped down machines. But those are pretty desirable machines. And I've had a few of those, which I like. But, you know, I have most of the machines that I've been longing for. I will say, you know, the one machine that I am not a fan of, and I've had 3 or 4 of them, is the Corona 4s.
Yep, they can be finicky.
I was cringing because I was waiting for you to say Remington Noiseless, and I was going to cry.
No, I like those. No, the Corona 4s, I don't know. I've had 3 or 4. They're very, very, very finicky.
Yep, yeah, you know? Absolutely.
I like, they're fun to look at, but it's hard to get your fingers on them, too.
Yeah.
Well, Scott, it's been a wonderful experience chatting with you this past hour-ish, and I want to finish it off again by letting people know. Tell us again one more time about Steventown Typewriter Company.
So Steventown Typewriter Company. People can get in touch with me if they want. My email address is scottpeterconnors, S with an O, C-O-N-N-O-R-S, scottpeterconnors@gmail.com. And I've been, you know, doing this for quite a while, just hung the shingle out, so to speak, recently. So I'm on eBay, I'm on Facebook, I'm part of your group, which I love, one of my favorite groups, and I'm always posting stuff there, so you can get in touch with me there too.
Wonderful. And I got to close it with this, because you and Everett, I know, are big Royal P fans, but the Royal P Vogue that you keep describing about four or five different times in Austin, it's worth $50.
Absolutely.
Everett,
and Everett made me that offer, by the way.
No. Yeah, I've got two Vogues in the Royal P's, and those are two of my favorite. I've got one in bright red, and I've got one in the blue, and they're just the coolest, because the type font is deco and the machine is deco, and when you put those two together, there's really something magic about it. I can understand people's angst with they hadn't perfected the type font yet, and the spacing is a little weird, but it's so deco, and so I can understand you wouldn't want to write a novel with it necessarily, because of the font's not necessarily the easiest on the eyes, because it's sans serif and such, but there's something really magic about those machines to me that is just amazing.
Scott, any final thoughts?
I always wonder, when I sit down at any typewriter, who has sat here before me and what have they typed on this? Have they typed a love letter? Have they typed a suicide note? Have they typed a novel? Have they typed a journal? You know, have they used it exclusively for school? You know, and each machine, I think, has an energy and a life to it. And when I sit down, I think that energy gets transferred, and you can feel that sort of past that's in those machines when you sit down and begin to type on them. But I love the stories that go with the machines, and thank you guys for doing what you do every day and bringing us great podcasts and a great group.
All right. Well, thank you. Everett, any final thoughts?
No, none at all. This has been wonderful to listen to your story, Scott. This is great.
All right.
Well, thanks for joining us here. I'm here with Everito, Scott Connors. I'm Gimmiet, and you're listening to Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. Thank you for listening to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. For more information about our group, please find us online at austintypewriterinc.com, or you can also visit us on Facebook and Instagram. Join us next time for another episode of Austin Typewriter Inc. May your type slugs always be clean.